Struggling with sporadic releases and producer stagnation? Meet the Producer Growth Scorecard, a free tool I created to transform your music production game. Unleash efficiency and triple your output. It worked for me. Ready to elevate your music? Grab your free scorecard at synthmusicmastering.com/free.
You're listening to the Inside the Mix podcast with your host, Mark Matthews.
Hello and welcome to the Inside the Mix podcast. I'm Mark Matthews, your host, musician, producer, and mix and mastering engineer. You've come to the right place if you want to know more about your favorite synth music artists, music engineering and production, songwriting, and the music industry. I've been writing, producing, mixing, and mastering music for over 15 years, and I want to share what I've learned with you. Hey folks, welcome back to the Inside the Mix podcast. Now, in this episode, I'm very, very excited to welcome our guest today. We've got the one and only Michael Oakley joining us today. And so for those of you who are unsure who Michael is a Scottish singer producer who is residing in Canada. He's currently signed to New Retro Rave Records. His retro inspired electronic sound made its debut in 2017 with the album California, and it's continued through to the 2019 album Introspect and also Odyssey in 2021. So I've taken this from your Bandcamp here, Michael. So describe your music as melancholic postcards from my heart wrapped up in synthesizers and drum machines. I love that description, mate. How are you? And thanks for joining me.
that's like the Troy McClure intro. Hi, I'm Michael Oakley. You may remember me from such albums as.
Yeah, exactly.
No, thank you for having me. I'm very excited to do this, you know. I mean, I'm sure I say that with every interview. Some of them I'm less sincere than others. But I genuinely really love talking about the creative process, mm-hmm. because I think there's a lot of myths about the mm-hmm. creative process and the mixing and production process. And a podcast like this is the type of thing where we get to see the scaffolding. Because when people see the finished tracks, they don't see the different drafts of the track that was mm-hmm. along the way. They maybe don't see that the idea started out as a 16-bar loop that was 10 beats per minute faster in a completely different key and sounded nothing like what you heard in the record.
Yep.
So it's a great chance to kind of dive into that to sort of hopefully make people feel a lot better about the creative process, knowing that I make many, many mistakes, and that's an important part of the process.
Yeah, fantastic. And that is exactly what this podcast is about. So I'm really, really excited to dig into the creative processes and the songwriting and composition and music production and everything in between. So just for the audience listening, so what Michael's going to do, we're just going to go for a brief musical journey, as they say, just to just get anyone who hasn't heard of you just up to speed on where we're at. And then obviously we're going to discuss everything that you sort of aforementioned. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to jump forward a bit. So from your bio, I've taken it that you originally from Glasgow, and you were in the cover band scene and releasing music, and then you released the debut album of California. So I think what would be quite cool is, you're in a cover band, and then you sort of transitioned to that album of California. Maybe just a bit of background in terms of how you made that step from the cover band scene to California.
Well, even before that, I think I was in a band trying to get a mainstream record deal. And, the music that I was doing at that time, this is, we're going back to like 2007. And this was at a time when, retro was still a little bit regarded as hokey. Retro wasn't quite taken as seriously. I mean, retro was the Killers adding synthesizers into indie music. That was retro. And it wasn't the kind of authentic retro. It was just, here's some nice, microcorg sounds that sort of sound a little bit retro. That must be retro, but it wasn't. But yeah, I was in a band. We were doing music that was somewhere, between The Killers, Duran Duran, Coldplay, and it didn't work out. And the fallout from that for me was I kind of got, fed up of the whole thing. So do you do when you're a musician and you're fed up of writing music? You form a covers band and do weddings and, you whore out your talent for money.
Yep.
So joined a covers band in 2009. And I must say that that experience was invaluable, because you had to pick the songs which got people up on their feet. So when you were picking songs and you would play those songs on the night, you would get a real direct experience of watching body language, you know, Erasure, A Little Respect. Immediately people go on the dance floor. The Killers, Mr. Brightside, immediately you'll see them go on the dance floor. There's just certain songs that are timeless, and there's something charming and characteristic about those songs which evoke a certain in somebody that makes them want to get in the dance floor. So, I mean, I really got a good education on what songs are the ones which have stood the test of time and which ones are the ones that people emotionally connect with, certainly on a dance floor level. And so I was doing that for, must be about 7 years, 7 or 8 years. And then the opportunity and situation happened with New Retrowave, because I had got really sort of, it's funny because I got to a certain point in my life where, because I wasn't writing, I always felt like there was unfinished business. And because of that, there was an unhappiness, like that was just like, I have this thing that I want to do, and am I going to come into this life and not do the thing that I want to do and live a complete life of plan B, you know, like always settling for the second best option? So a few life situations happened. I had went through a separation from a girl that I was in a long-term relationship with. And the combination of that, feeling kind of like I wasn't happy in my place of life at that point, it kind of pushed me to start writing again, because I sort of had things to talk about. I can channel this cathartically into something, but this time I'm not going to make music that is for a record company. I'm not going to make music that's trying to fit in. I'm going to make the music that is what I wish was still being made, that I grew up as a kid listening to. And that was how the songs from my first album came about. And that was the transformation from that. It was quite rapid. The most shocking way I can put it is that within a year, I had emigrated, got married to someone else, and released an album, and traveled to Los Angeles to work with people to finish that album, and then woke up one day in Canada, married, with, funnily enough, with a kind of almost freak out anxiety, because I was just like, oh my god, like, has all this really happened to me? Like, it's like you sort of start to catch up with yourself. So yeah, I mean, it was quite instantaneous, like, just how that all came about. But, you know, I'm someone, I don't believe there's errors in the system, you know, like in life. I do think that, you know, that you have to, if you really want something, then you have to go through a series of obstacles, challenges to overcome, to really say, do you really want it? Okay, your relationship's going to hit the skids. Do you really want it? Okay, well, now you're not going to be happy in your job, because that unhappiness is what's going to be the driving force behind pushing you to elevate yourself to do the thing you want. Are you sure you want this? And it's that continual thing. Sometimes people get to a point in their life where they say, oh, I don't want to suffer anymore. I'm just happy to settle. Whereas I was aware that I would be so unhappy if I didn't pursue it. And if I was married to somebody and I was still in a covers band not pursuing it, I would be their nightmare, truly.
Yeah, that is a rapid transition. And I think what you said there at the end about how you get to a point whereby, do you want to pursue it, and you make that decision. And I was listening to a podcast, or it might have been a short, the other day, and it was there was I don't know if it's evidence-based research, which was to say that often when you are at that point and you kick it to the curb, it's at that point often that you could have then kicked on and done what it is that you wanted to do, which I thought was quite interesting.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. At that point is usually the point where you're literally standing at the door ready to knock.
Yeah,
And you're just, no, this is silly. You know, something gets in your head. Now, for me, I guess I had a disadvantage of growing up in Glasgow, because in the underbelly of Glasgow, there's this kind of mentality of, and I talk about it in Glasgow song when I, you know, the line, "Don't reach above your station." There's in Glasgow, you can't really wear like flashy designer clothes, because your friends will say, "Who do you think you are? You know, what are you dressed like that for?" And it's a sort of joke sort of thing. They do it as a sort of joke, but underneath that, there is that little element of, who do you think you are? You know, you're not Michael Bublé, you're Michael Oakley. Who do you think you are? And there was always that kind of underbelly of that mentality of staying small and not reaching for your dreams, because it didn't really happen for a lot of people where I grew up. You know what I mean? It was, I didn't grow up in poverty or anything like that, but I certainly grew up in a very working class area, and you know, it was always about, there's not many people that become successful musicians. You know, that can be your hobby. What are you going to do for a career? And it was like, well, I want to do music. And I even thought about this, because I went to university, and I was going to become, well, in my head, I was going to become a teacher, like a lecturer at a college, a music lecturer. And halfway through the course, I realized, what am I doing? This is not me. You know, I'm not only too immature for this, there's somewhere else I have to be. You know, it was that feeling of, I want to do music, but I want to write music, and I want to have like a career as a singer-songwriter. And but the weight of the scale of the thing seems so insurmountable that you think, maybe I'll just stay claiming my, you know, my bursary every month and just get a part-time job because it's easy. And you know, you take the easy option, but like you say, you know, sometimes you can get people who are literally standing at the door of the success that they're looking for, and that little voice that I might have had from Glasgow of, who do you think you are, Michael? This is a pipe dream, you know. That little voice could creep in to sort of tap you in the shoulder and tempt you, and then you say, and you wouldn't even know that you were at the door ready. Yeah. I mean, but everybody, every single person who's been successful has some kind of backstory of, you know, overcoming challenges, their own personal challenges or demons to get to where they want to. And there comes a point where you've got to get real about what you want and how you're going to get it.
We'll be right back.
Hey, how's it going? Just a friendly reminder, make sure you don't miss out on the Producer Growth Scorecard. It's an amazing tool that can seriously level up your music production game and speed up your music releases. The best part, it will not cost you a single penny. Yep, it is totally free. Don't let this opportunity slip away, folks. Take a moment to grab your own Producer Growth Scorecard at synthmusicmastering.com/free. Yeah, I totally agree with that. And it's amazing, it's amazing to think, if you could quantify the amount of people who were at that door and didn't quite take that leap of faith and then went with it. It would be it's a stark number of people, I imagine. So that's quite nice. It's not quite nice, but I was going to say it segued nicely then into our music production and songwriting side of things. And what you mentioned earlier about myths. Now, I'm really intrigued by this.
It's not a word I use often.
Yeah, I cannot wait to, and I'm sure the audience is salivating at the prospect of what these myths might be, but I think it'd be quite cool to start with. Now, what I think is also, before I mention this question, is having looked at your sort of repertoire on YouTube and whatnot, is that you actually list the tech that you're using from your productions, which we'll dig into a bit in a minute, because specifically the Ableton 10 versus Reason, which I'm quite intrigued to learn more about. But I think what would be quite cool, because it is a songwriting music production, so is maybe if we start like the songwriting process. So you're in a situation whereby you're writing music. How does a song start for Michael Oakley? Where do you begin?
Well, usually if I'm sitting trying to sort of just compose ideas, I do a whole pre-production process that I encourage everyone to do who's an electronic musician. So you know, the kind of back thing for most producers is, oh, I'm going to get a DAW. So you decide on what you're going to use. In my case, it's Ableton at this moment in time. And then you say, okay, some of the stock stuff is good. It's okay. Some of it's really good, but I need to get some synthesizers. So you buy a bunch of synthesizers and plugins like, you know, reverb effects, EQs, more niche type effect stuff. And that sort of forms your toolbox. Now, most people don't go through the synth, because all synthesizers now have like a menu option where you can star favorite your sounds. I go through every single synthesizer that I have and I favorite the sounds that I like the most, so that when I open that synthesizer up, I only see the sounds that I like, because I don't want to waste time when I'm composing. The last thing I want to do is spend half an hour chasing a bass sound or half an hour chasing a snare drum sound. I mean, it's, you know, you have to really get from A to B as in the flow as quickly as possible. So when I sit down, I default to usually likes of Omnisphere, maybe. I love Omnisphere. I love Reveal Sound Spire. Those two are probably my favorite and most used out of all of the synthesizers that I have. I find that's a sound I gravitate towards. So I'll open those up and I have my own, I guess, private reserve, we'll call, of my favorite sounds that I've selected, so that when I go through them, oh, there's that pad sound, that's really nice. And I'll start to kind of play around and find something, maybe a chord sequence, or if it's a more poly-based sound, maybe I'll come up with a sort of little arpeggiated riff-type thing, and then I'll start to revolve around something. Something will just click, and it will just be like, that's nice. I'm going to start to either continue to affect the sound if I want to take it more lo-fi or add more effects to it, and then I'll start to build around that. But another way I do like to work is I like to kind of find some drum sounds and build just a kind of a loop. I mean, so I've certainly had moments where I've been out listening to like a playlist and I hear a track and I think those drums are really nice, you know, that the vibe of those drums, and I will go home and recreate my version of that type of drum sound and then start to build something completely different around maybe the drum arrangement that I heard. I've certainly done that a few times. But I think that that's the crucial part, is if you're going to buy plugins, know how to use them. You know, like, I know preset surfing is kind of fashionable these days, and that's fine. But you really want to know how to use the tools that you have. I'm going through a bit of a reduction phase at this point, actually, before I start writing for my next album. And I guess the principle is less is more. And I mean, I'm terrible. I mean, you know, people talk about gear acquiring syndrome. Like, I am plug-in acquiring syndrome. And I literally have went now from probably about maybe 24 synthesizer plugins down to like 10. And I'm going to cut it down even more, just to the nucleus of the sounds that I want to work with. Because that's another key component I think people maybe miss, is limitations are your friend. I used to like have a hardware setup, and I had like a Juno 106, an Akai S2000 sampler, a Zoom 1201 and like effects multi effects unit, everyone had the Alesis 3630 compressor. I had that, and a couple of rack synthesizers, a JV-1010, which is this little box that had all the 1080 sounds. And I was using MIDI. I was using a crappy old PC running Cubase MIDI, a mixing desk. And, you know, I only had 16 channels to work with at that point with the Cubase I was using. So you were stuck with 16 tracks. And then polyphony, things like that, you know, that this only has 32 note polyphony. So if you're using this as a multi-timbral module, you know, you've got to be really careful about what sounds you choose to use from that. Or are you going to bounce the sound to a sampler if it's drums to free up 8 notes of polyphony? And those limitations, they were a little frustrating, but they forced you to really get the best out of what you had. Whereas now, the possibilities are endless. And I think that that actually is doing harm to creativity. I think people are maybe a little too convenient to use presets and drop stuff on and slap effects on without quite understanding fully how to use them and what maybe like new ways that you can use and find your signature. Because within all the plugins you use, I have a signature within the plugins I use, because there's a certain way that I use those plugins that no one else will. There's just certain things I like, if you know what I mean. Like there's a reverb plugin I love called Seventh Heaven, and it is a gorgeous reverb, but I only like to use it for drums because it just is. There's something about the room sound of that reverb that really makes me feel like, oh, that makes the drum room feel of those whole of those sounds together feel quite organic. But other people would probably use it for more likely for a vocal, you know, and other instruments maybe, just to get a different feel. You know, you want to sort of find out what your interpretation of how you use those plugins are, and you only get that by really understanding how to use the tools that you have. It's better to have two synthesizer plugins, one reverb, and maybe a couple of other multi-effects things, a compressor, and know how to use those, than having 15 synthesizer plugins, 5 reverbs, and a whole bunch of other, and you're just hoping for the best, and dropping the plugin on, finding a preset, and you don't know how it works. I mean, you really do have to know your tools to get the best out of them.
Yeah, I totally agree with that, and it might sound quite harsh, but it's kind of like the old saying of all the gear and no idea, in a way, isn't it? You're buying all this stuff, all these VST, all these plugins, in the hope that you put something together. And because you've got so many possibilities, that something's going to materialize. What I'd never considered is what you said right at the beginning there, is actually going through the plugin itself and favoriting all the, because I do favorite patches that I find, but it's more of a case of like, I'll surf through and then favorite. But I don't know why I never considered doing that before. I'm actually just going through the VST, the plugin, and then favoriting the sounds. Because much like you, when it comes to production, I do have there's a particular sound that I like, and whether it's pads, whether it's leads, strings, or whatever. I do generally come back to those. But I definitely agree with the fact that I think when it comes to plugins and specifically sound design, knowing how to, just the basics really, like LFOs and envelopes, and just knowing how to use them and how they can interact and how you can start to manipulate those pre-existing sounds is crucial. Is that something that you sort of learned through experimentation, or did you do some sort of course, or did it come organically?
I think it's probably a combination of organically, and probably one of the biggest learning experiences that I had, and not a lot of people know this about me, but I do a lot of work for sample pack companies, software developer companies. I've done work for Splice, Sample Magic, Sennheiser, Roland, on their cloud service. I've done work for Reveal Sound, even, because I love Spire. And a lot of synthesizers I've done preset banks for.
Yeah.
And I think probably the biggest learning curve that I got was probably when I started working for those companies, because it was a different mindset. You know, I was switching from composing and making sounds that I would use for my productions to a new mindset of I'm creating a product that has to have a diverse range of sounds that will maybe appeal to a wider range of people. I mean, that's what a factory sound bank is on any synthesizer. You know, there's probably about 3/4 of the factory library you'll never use, maybe more, you know. I only use probably about 5% of a sound library on a factory, if even, you know. You just find what you like and you use it. But that was the biggest learning curve, because then I had to really find out, how do you make that sound? You know, what is it that you do with the envelopes and the filter, and what type of filter to get that type of sound? You know, it's that was a different learning curve. And I think that that has been one of the best learning curve experiences for me, because now I'm much faster at tweaking to find the sound that I'm looking for in my own productions, actually. Definitely. And because I was working in different styles, I was kind of forced to work in more pop based styles, modern pop, trance music, IDM stuff. And you know, it's amazing the shift of mindset, because you know, with you know, I guess a really easy description of when you make retro type sounds, you know, you can instantly get that retro sound by putting the attack up slightly on the filter of the ADSR, because it makes it just a little bit quacky, you know, that kind of wow wow, and immediately that just evokes those kind of bass sounds that are 80s sounds or poly sounds or brass sounds, and so that's a, you know, a very condensed description, but it's just little things like that. Yeah. You know, the attack can really change the face of something on the filter. You know, but yeah, it's that's been the biggest learning curve, I think, because it pushed me, because then it was, okay, if I don't do this, I'm not getting paid. You've got that sort of, the deadline is this, so you have to meet this deadline. So it's like, right, how do I make that PPG wave choir sound on this synthesizer using formants? It's like, okay, I need to figure this out. And you're pushing yourself, you're pushing your comfort zones.
Yeah. Do you think that specifically with plugins, and because we're chatting about plugins, but do you think there could be a tendency for them to be overly complicated? Now, there's a plugin that I use in particular, and I really like, and it's Anna 2, and I think it's a fantastic plugin. They market it as the Netflix of plugins, and it goes back to what you said there about appealing to everyone, because the sound bank on it, or in it rather, is huge, and much like you, I probably don't touch half of it, if not like 3/4 of it. But do you think there could be a tendency for them to be a bit too complicated? Or too many features?
Yes, I think so. I think so. I think that there's probably, we're splitting the musician level from beginner to intermediate to more advanced, for sure. And more advanced musician producers would use something like Pigments.
Yeah, I love
by
Pigments.
Arturia. Anna 2 is actually not too bad, but then like it's a really good synthesizer plugin. Mm. I can see from the GUI how, you know, you could maybe be intimidated a little bit, but it is actually very simple. It's all laid out. But Anna 2 sounds great. That is a really good synthesizer. I've used that before. But then something like, it's amazing. I think the interface of a plugin will determine whether or not you like it or not. There's a lot to do with the GUI, because the GUI on Spire for me was one of the biggest caveats. I mean, I love the sound of Spire first and foremost, but the interface is very accessible. It's very easy to get to grips with. It's not so advanced that you can't understand it, you know. Certainly if you, I mean, this is going back to when I was working with a hardware setup, you know, I had to manually wire the routing for things, you know, even little things like, oh, this multi-effects unit, I have to connect the out for the auxiliaries to the mixing desk so that I can then, like, turn up the auxiliary on each channel to get reverb on this, but not on this, but on this and this, and then I want delay on auxiliary two, and you had to learn about routing. And similarly with, you know, synthesizers, you need to have an understanding about routing to know that if you assign the cutoff filter to the ADSR, then that's going to change again the, you know, just the shape of the sound, and it's a different type of thing. But then if you just assign, like Savon Spire, you can just assign the main oscillator ADSR to it, then you've only got one control because you're then just controlling that. But if you have that separate and you have the filter to a separate ADSR, then you can actually control the body of the sound with the main ADSR, and then the filter to the other ADSR, the envelope, will give it a different character. I mean, I like to always put it to a separate ADSR because then sometimes the sound can have a bit too much body, so I like to take off the sustain maybe and just have the decay on and pull that back, and then it slightly just shapes the sound just a little bit more to what you're looking for it to be. But there has been some plugins where the GUI has put me off using it, for sure. I've bought a couple of plugins and just haven't enjoyed using it, and I've then just deleted it off of my iMac.
Yeah, kind of like
when I'm not going to name any, just in case.
No. It might be nice if they come knocking at my door for some of endorsement. I don't want to write them off before they've come knocking, you know. But no, it's quite interesting that you mentioned that, because you do see some plugins in there. It looks like they've sort of like done the kitchen sink sort of thing with them, tried to get to appeal to everyone by putting everything in there. And I think it's cutting off the nose to spite their face, for want of a better way of putting it.
I tell you one actually just the other day, actually, Tau Sampler completely updated their GUI, and it's night and day. It is a much better interface, and actually just the way it looks visually, there's less colors, there's less like, I guess what I would call ADHD inducing. What is all this? Why is there so many colours on this? And I love Tau Sampler, but I'm glad that they changed the GUI on that, because now it looks a lot more streamlined and it's easier in the eye.
Yeah, I agree with that. I haven't seen the update, but I know when I've done like little shorts that I've put on Instagram or whatever, when I'm just going a little demo of a plugin, and I always refer back, and I've said it in previous podcasts, that I always go back to plugins where there's, I don't like all the flashiness around the plugin and all these extra bits of animation. I don't need to see the spinning tape underneath. I just want it to work, and I want the controls to be there, and I want it to be intuitive. I don't need everything else. And I always, and every time I see that or I see an update with that, I'm sort of like, I'm totally on board with it. So I totally agree with you on that one there. So with regards to sound design, say if you're a producer who's just starting out, what part of the sound design process should a new producer or new sound designer start experimenting with or learning about?
It depends. I mean, if I always wanted to make sounds, whereas I know that not everybody that I know who is a composer wants to sit making sounds. They just want to preset surf. And I mean, that's fine, because there's a wealth of, you could buy Nexus and load that up with expansions. I mean, like I say, it's a very different process for me when I'm composing, because I fall into that category probably where, you know, I do edit the sounds to the shape of what I'm looking for, but most of the time I'm looking to find the closest approximation of a preset that will fit what I'm looking for, and then take it from there, rather than start from scratch. But I do think that it's crucial for, you know, producers to have an understanding of sound design, certainly, you know. I mean, even if they just know ADSR and how that works, attack, decay, sustain, yeah. release, how to shape a sound, and then also how to assign, I mean, the most common thing, assigning the filter to a separate ADSR and just seeing the difference of how that changes the sound, you know, seeing what different poles of filters will do and how that changes the sound. I don't think you'd have to get too in-depth to know the basic tenets of that. But I do most certainly advise that you know how to do that. Effects is a completely different animal, but again, you know, I honestly think that the most I've ever learned from like production is through simply just sitting, opening up the device and just playing with it until I'm like, oh, okay, that's nice. And then you understand how it works and you start to go, oh, okay, rather than watching too many tutorials, because there's nothing better than in field, yeah. just getting your hands dirty and just doing it, load a piano sound or something and then just start slapping on a new reverb and saying, okay, this is a lot more digital sounding and there's more decay time for this, and because of that it gives you nicer drone sounds. You know, you start to sort of get these little opinions that you have of the plugins, like, oh, that's better for drones. A favorite reverb of mine is Native Instruments ROM, and I love it because there's the freeze function, and the freeze function can allow you to make some great textures. I mean, really, if you want to make background ambient textures or pad type stuff, you can really create some really nice stuff, freeze it, export it to Wave, and then start to manipulate that to your liking. But that's like, again, you know, this is just trial and error. I've came to that conclusion because that's my preference of how I like to use it. But that's a reverb that's got like a 60-second decay time. and a lot of people would probably think, well, what the hell would I want to do that for? Well, because if you cut the low end off and you just end up with that nice air, that's how you get a lot of those Ulrich Schnauss type dreamy Vangelis sort of things. You know, everyone knows that, you know, reverb, if it's too much low end on the EQ of the reverb, you just get mud and you just get a horrible it's in the mix. But when you cut that out, it obviously allows more breathing space for the whole thing. But that works for long decays, you know, on pads, on like little poly sounds. It can just like arpeggiators in particular, like just dreamy sort of arps. It adds a nice air to the whole thing, and you can pull it right back in the mix, but it just creates that nice floating kind of ambience in the background that just makes it feel otherworldly.
Yeah, fantastic. A 60 second decay. I'm going to have to look this up. I haven't used that particular plugin, but I love the sound of that, because much like yourself, I like creating those really sort of ambient and rich textures like you described there. And I think that's something I need to have in my weaponry.
For all you music fanatics out there, here's a podcast to add to your must-listen list. Nakedly Examined Music is a podcast about songs and songwriting. In each episode, host Mark Linsenmeyer speaks with a songwriter about three of their songs, which you get to hear in full. Nakedly Examined Music explores what motivates creative decisions at every step of a song's creation, from the initial idea to the final recording. It also provides a picture of how a songwriter's work has changed over the course of their career. This is an ideal context for introducing you to new music, and you're going to come away from the podcast with many new favorite songs. You're also going to learn more about legendary artists, and you'll get filled in on scenes and genres that you always felt like you should know more about. You'll come away a better listener and a more inspired creator. Start listening today wherever you listen to your podcasts, or find the show at nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. One question that sprung to mind then, whilst you were talking, is, have you ever, like, I've used Reactor in the past, Native Instruments Reactor. I haven't used it for quite some time.
Have you ever created your own synth and used that in your production? So something like Reactor, or I know Max MSP, I don't know if you'd use that in a production, but maybe something like Reactor and created your own synth from scratch and use that.
I know of Reactor. I have Native Instruments Contact, and I have a few of those instruments. I did have Absinthe as well. I mean, they seem to have done quite a few bits and pieces that are like that, but I've never, I mean, in terms of modular, I guess, like building blocks, it's too time consuming for me. I don't really like to spend too much time, like when I'm trying to create, certainly, because it gets in the way of the creative process. But then I also would have to counter that with some people who are musicians like to make more experimental, progressive, you know, sound morphing based music, like ambient music in particular, and a lot of kind of progressive techno stuff has more of that kind of evolving thing, so that sort of sound works for that, whereas I'm more about melodies and building something that would constitute a song. So yeah, you know, I have structure where I've got, you know, intro, verse, pre-chorus, chorus, you know, that sort of thing, a bridge and whatever that I've got going on in the track. Whereas if I was doing more experimental and looking at a larger, longer thing, then I would probably be into that. But it just doesn't appeal to me for my type of music production, although it is fun.
Yeah, I can imagine it is very time consuming creating it. I remember when I did it, and I think the end product wasn't, this is way back when, the end product wasn't particularly great. And I kind of looked at it afterwards and said, I probably could have spent that time a lot better doing something else. But you sort of live and learn. I'm well aware of time here. We're already 40 minutes in and I've still got a raft of questions here. But this is brilliant. I'm loving
this. Right.
So yeah. So what I think would be quite cool is to maybe, move on to a bit of the because we've talked about synthesizers and whatnot, and maybe delve into a bit more in terms of the DAWs that you use. So in what I've picked up on from online is that you're using Ableton and a bit of Reason. Now, are you rewiring them for one of what I think that's what Logic calls it. I don't know if other DAWs call it that. But maybe a bit more of why you've opted for Ableton. And I know you said you used Cubase in the past. And maybe why you use Reason as well.
Well, when I used Cubase, Cubase, it was just simply because I had like an old Pentium, you know, we're talking way back in like 1998, you know, that kind of period when I started to build a hardware setup, because I was just like a kid, you know, I was like 15 or something, making music with whatever gear that I could get my hands on, you know, and that I sold all of that gear to buy a laptop. This is 2004. And I sold all of that hardware setup to buy a laptop in Reason 2.5 and just run a USB controller keyboard. Similar to, I mean, almost like the one I've got, you know, here right now. But I had that. And I actually found that I was way more productive with Reason than I was with my hardware setup, because the challenges with a hardware setup are you can't work on multiple tracks at the same time without having to then recalibrate every single device to the specifications of what that track had. And I was spending 20 minutes setting up hardware for, oh yeah, this song has these settings on the sampler, and then I need to load in the SCSI drive of samples in, you know, and all that stuff. So I got the laptop and immediately started to make more music because I could save the session. It was like automatic recall, and I would be working on several ideas at the same time. So moved to Reason, but again, the technology limitations of the time meant that I still could only run like 12 tracks, you know, on this like crap laptop. I mean, it was like technology still hadn't quite caught up unless you had thousands and thousands to spend, and I didn't. So it was literally, again, I was forced with limitations to have to bounce parts and trigger them as wave samples. And that was interesting. But then I got a better laptop over the time, and I've eventually managed to get to afford a MacBook Pro, and that was it. You know, I was using the latest version of Reason at that point, and that was what I guess I used for the entire California album, was using Propellerhead Reason, which is now Reason Studios. But I moved over to Ableton for Introspect for my second album, because the VST support at that time for Propellerhead Reason was not good. It was just too unpredictable. And, you know, I could only use two instances of Reveal Sound Spire, and the thing was, you know, clocking up that it was, the computer was too slow, and that wasn't the case because I tried out Ableton and I could load 10 instances of Spire with no problem, and it was still only like 20% CPU. So I really only switched from Reason to Ableton out of frustration, because I couldn't use the plugins that I wanted to. I was in the middle of a song working on a track for Introspect, and I couldn't get any further ahead because just the implementation was really frustrating. So I ended up converting that session over to Ableton, and like I had to bounce all the MIDI and then load in and find the same settings. And I just thought, I'm not going back until this has been fixed. So I'm still on Ableton right now. I mean, I love the platform. I think that Reason's a wonderful platform. It is incredible. There is no software package that offers that amount of tools in one box for what it does. It is the best for inbox, especially if you're an electronic musician. It has, the way it's laid out is almost like old school, like a rack with that. That appealed to me. The visual aesthetic of Reason is just so alluring. You know, you've got your samplers, the way they're laid out, and you can use them like an old school sampler. The synthesizer's laid out in a way, here's your subtractive synthesizer, here's your more additive type synthesizer, and here is a more modular based synthesizer. So they, you know, they catered for different types of things within that program. So it still is a phenomenal program. And I have used it again. I rewired it into Ableton. And have used some of the sounds that way, although I don't see myself using the platform as my sole platform, and then using external plugins as third party plugins in that. I just think Ableton's a more stable platform for that. But I have such a deep love and affinity for Reason because it is just such a wonderful program. But yeah, just the workflow I like better in Ableton. It's just a lot better for working with audio as well, I think. Dragging and dropping audio, chopping audio, you know, just working with it. But yeah, so from that moment on, I've now been a user of Ableton, occasionally bringing Reason into Ableton if there's any particular things that I want to use from that platform.
Yeah, I can see why you'd make that jump from Reason to Ableton. I've used Ableton a bit myself, and you're right that I think in terms of like the manipulation capabilities of Ableton, it's so quick. And like the flex time, I know in Logic they call it flex time. I think it's called something similar in Ableton from when I used it. It's so good. And it doesn't impart artifacts on what you're doing as well. And it's very intuitive. And you've also got the element whereby I know you do. You're on the live scene as well. Are you using Ableton to trigger sounds when you're performing as well?
Yeah, I use Ableton whenever I've done live shows, and it's been solid as a rock. I mean, I've never had a crash or any issues with the platform. It's very stable. And that was triggering a click track to my drummer and the guitarist, you know, like sending multiple signals out and things like that. And yeah, it's very stable for that. I mean, the whole concept of Ableton Live was that it was originally conceived as a live performance tool, and then it was an afterthought that it got used as an actual recording platform. And it's kind of strange how it's morphed into being a recording platform that people happen to use as a live platform, because it was actually conceived as the opposite of that. And then I think they just completely changed the platform to suit that ideology shift.
Yeah, I can see that. They kind of pivoted. I guess they realized, you know what, if we've got more producers using this for the actual production element, we probably need to lean into that direction. But going back to what you said about Reason, I used Reason 5. And I think that was, I'm fairly certain Reason 5 was before you were it allowed you to use third-party plugins. I could be wrong.
They just were so late. They were so late to the game with implementing VST. And I think that they tried to do rack extensions as their third-party plugin, and I think it was kind of fun for a little while, but I just didn't think that that ecosystem was going to be a long-term work, because the game changed so much. I mean, I think a lot of what made Reason very, very alluring to people to use was the fact that this is the most CPU efficient program. So, you know, if you've got a mid-level PC, you know, then you can run this platform very, very well. You know, it's such a great ecosystem. It's very economical with your CPU and RAM. Whereas what happened was technology got to a point where, you know, your default home computer now has a quad-core processor. So, you know, so it's like that now is not really a factor in people's minds where they're like, oh, I need to save CPU, you know, because this might not run. You know, now people don't have that concern. And I just think that Propellerhead were way too late to the game in implementing VST into that platform, especially when you had things like Omnisphere coming out and all these great third-party software plugins that people wanted to use. You know, people wanted to use the Korg legacy software like M1, and I just think they were a little slow to catch up to that. You know, I think it hurt them actually.
Yeah, I would agree, because much like what you said earlier with regards to, because I can't remember the actual keyboard shortcut, but you can flip it around with Reason, can't you? You can see the rewiring on the back and you can actually start moving and rip and patching things together, which I thought was amazing when I was starting out. And I think it was the synthesizer Thor. I think it was called Thor that came with Reason. I loved that when I was starting out. I mean, that was a great tool to start out with.
Sounds great.
It does it. I haven't used it in ages. Does it still sound good?
It's wonderful. It really is. It's it still has a certain quality characteristic which you think you're impressed by when you hear it. But I think that the other ones maybe haven't aged so well. You know, Subtractor. Maelstrom.
Oh, that was, yes, I remember those. Yeah. Man, I haven't used those in years. It's one of those ones where I shouldn't, like, I mean, I could make time. I'd love to go back and look at Reason again and start using it, because I know I've spoken to a few producers that use it. But it's great to hear that your first album was done solely with Reason. I wasn't aware of that. I think that's amazing. That's brilliant.
Most of my friends were using Reason.
Yeah.
And with each update, they got angrier and more frustrated, and they felt, I mean, I can remember the moment when they announced VST implementation, but they didn't give VST 3, I think it was. It was one of them. You were only able to get one layer of VST. I think it was VST 2, but they didn't offer VST 3. And again, it was a sort of like, give us VST and give us it properly. You know, we're paying for an update here. And most of my friends who no longer now use Reason, and they were like diehard fanatics of Reason. They were religiously like fanboys of Reason, they switched because they were so angry at paying for an update, and then they felt that they had been shortchanged too many times. And I can understand why, because I felt frustrated. I felt like the updates that they had put out there just really came up short. You know, they should have given us VST 10 years before that they announced it.
Weird, you isn't know? It? You'd think, I think as an organization, they look at the landscape and think, you know what, these other companies are doing this and they're seeing that success. Then, but I don't know, the powers that be and the decisions they make. But yeah, like you say, a bit late to the game. Michael, once again, we're almost at the hour mark here, and this is fantastic. I realize I've still got so many questions. Make sure you check out next week's episode, episode 55 of the Inside the Mix podcast, for Michael Oakley, part two.
This is Tim Benson, aka R9. My favorite episode of Inside the Mix podcast is episode 40 with Zach Vortex. I really love this one, as it gives a real insight into Zach's own work ethic, his music, how he markets himself and manages to balance all of this with his family life.